Humboldt believes that the ancient Hindus were ancient Aryans who discovered climate having arrived as invaders in the lush climate of India. Among the many problems with this narrative is its erasure of non-Brahminical forms of knowledge. The idea that the Indus people of the ancient cities of the Indus civilization were the actual source of these theories, and not the invading Aryans, does not occur to him because the ancient Indus has not been discovered. Another is its prioritization of certain forms of Indian knowledge, even within the mystical tradition. Take the two verses from Sufi poet Shah Abdul Latif, whose Song of the Spring and Song of the Desert reflect two very different theories of climate. The former is much closer to the messenger of clouds which Humboldt evokes. Is what Humboldt takes to be the Indian theory of climate, even in his highly appreciative acknowledgement of its contribution to climate. Knowledge as he understands, closer to one of these poems more than the other? Sufi poet Shah Abdul Latif, section from Sir Sarang, Song of the Spring. The rain is remembered by men, by deer, and by buffaloes. The ducks are sustained by the clouds and rainbirds sing their songs. The shells in the sea wait for it every day. Give the herdsmen rainwater to drink, so that they may be happy. The rains are marked by lines like the redness of lac. The clouds are marked by patterns like those printed on a shawl. It has rained over Bit and filled the pools of Kirat. Elephants learn their graceful gait from the movement of the clouds. The west wind brings flashes of lightning from the direction Fokambat. He drives the buffaloes with twisted horns on their path and sets the calves upon their way. The herdsmen are happy. Their thirst and the hat are removed. The sudden rain will soak the plains. The cloudy skies have returned and have once again made it rain. All around and in every direction storms of lightning have come to announce the rain. Some have arisen and gone to Istanbul. Some have proceeded to the west. Some flash away China. Some take care of Samarkand. Some have bussed themselves over Jaisalmer. Some have rained over Bikaner. Some have drenched Pug. Some have descended on the Dat Desert. Some have passed over Umarkot and have made the ground green. Oh my God, make Sindh flourish forever. Dear friend and sweet beloved, make the whole world prosperous. Sir Dahar's Song of the Desert. In truth, the branch is dry, on its banks. So dry it is that no merchants, and no tax collectors, themselves show. 5. The branch is dry, save its bottom, dry grass grows. All around Patihal branch never since then in water abound. Rarely does one come across signs of human beings. The fishermen knew that branch's water would not be the same. They sailed with their boats away from that place, causing worry to prosperous merchants and businessmen. Oh, big fish, when the branch was full, you returned not. 1.7. Now in shallow pool you have been caught, on your head, bare onslaught of fishermen's blows. 8. When water was in abundance, you returned not. Today or tomorrow you will be in the net of fishermen caught. 9. When water's level was high, you returned not. Fishermen now with stakes have blocked all your paths. Humboldt. We have hitherto depicted the contrasts manifested according to the different periods of time in the closely allied literature of the Greeks and Romans, but differences in the mode of thought are not limited to those which must be ascribed to the age alone, that is to say, to passing events which are constantly modified by changes in the form of government, social manners and religious belief. For the most striking differences are those generated by varieties of races and of intellectual development. How different are the manifestations of an animated love for nature and a poetic colouring of natural descriptions among the nations of Hellenic, Northern Germanic, Semitic, Persian or Indian descent. The opinion has been repeatedly expressed that the love of nature evinced by Northern nations is to be referred to an innate longing for the pleasant fields of Italy and Greece and for the wonderful luxuriance of tropical vegetation when contrasted with their own prolonged deprivation of the enjoyment of nature during the dreary season of winter. We do not deny that this longing for the land of palms diminishes as we approach southern France or the Spanish peninsula, but the now generally adopted and ethnologically correct term of Indo-Germanic nations should remind us that too general an influence ought not to be ascribed to northern winters. The luxuriant poetic literature of the Indians teaches us that within and near the trop, ICS, south of the chain of the Himalaya, ever verdant and ever-blooming forests have at all times powerfully excited the imaginations of the East Aryan nations, and that they have always been more inclined toward poetic delineations of nature than the true Germanic races who have spread themselves over the inhospitable north as far as Iceland, the happier. Climates of southern Asia are not, however, exempt from a certain deprivation or at least an interruption of the enjoyment of nature, for the seasons are abruptly divided from each other by an alternation of fructifying rain and arid day, destructive drought. In the West Aryan plateau of Persia, the barren wilderness penetrates in many parts in the form of bays into the surrounding highly fruitful lands. A margin of forest land often constitutes the boundary of these far extending seas of steppe in Central and Western Asia. In this manner, the relations of the soil present the inhabitants of these torrid regions with the same contrast of barrenness and vegetable abundance in a horizontal plane as is manifested in a vertical direction by the snow-covered mountain chains of India and of Afghanistan. Great contrasts in seasons, vegetation, and elevation are always found to be exciting elements of poetic fancy, where an animated love for the contemplation of nature is closely interwoven with the mental culture and the religious aspirations of a people. We have already observed that, although sentimental and romantic excitement of feeling may be considered as in a high degree characteristic of Tyre, Indo-Germanic races of Northern Europe, it cannot be alone referred to climate, or in other words, to a longing increased by protracted deprivation. We have already remarked how the literature of the Indians and Persians, which has been developed under the genial glow of southern climes, presents the most charming descriptions, not only of organic but of inanimate nature, of the transition from drought to tropical rain, of the appearance of the first cloud on the deep azure of the pure sky, when the long-desired Etesian winds are first heard to rustle afeed the feathery foliage of the lofty palms. The present would appear a fitting place to enter somewhat further into the domain of Indian delineations of nature. If we suppose, writes Lassen in his admirable work on Indian antiquity, that a part of the Aryan race emigrated to India from their native region in the northwestern portion of the continent, they would have found themselves surrounded by a wholly unknown and marvelously luxuriant vegetation. The mildness of the climate, the fruitfulness of the soil, and its rich and spontaneous products must have imparted a brighter coloring to the new life opened before them. Owing to the originally noble characteristics of the Aryan race, and the possession of superior mental endowments in which lay the germ of all the nobleness and greatness to which the Indians have attained, the aspect of external nature gave rise in the minds of these nations to a deep meditation on the forces of nature, which has proved the means of inducing that contemplative tendency which we find so intimately interwoven in the most ancient poetry of the Indians. The all-powerful impression thus produced on the minds of the people is most clearly manifested in the fundamental dogma of their belief, the recognition of the divine in nature. The freedom from care and the ease of supporting existence in such a climate were also conducive to the same contemplative tendency. Who could devote themselves with less hindrance to a profound meditation of earthly fife, of the conditiope of man after death, and of the divine essence, than the anchorites, dwelling amid forests, the Brahmins of India, whose ancient schools constitute one of the most remarkable phenomena of Indian life, and must have exercised a special influence on the mental development of the whole race? In referring here, as I did in my public lectures, under the guidance of my brother and other learned Sanskrit scholars, to individual instances of that animated and frequently expressed feeling for nature which breathes through the descriptive portions of Indian poetry, I would begin with the Vedas, the innermost, ancient, and most valuable memorials of the civilization of the East Aryan nations. The main subject of these writings is the veneration and praise of nature. The hymns of the Rig Veda contain the most charming descriptions of the roseate hue of early dawn and of the aspect of the golden-handed sun. The great heroic poems of Ramayana and Mahabharata are of more recent date than the Vedas, but more ancient than the Puranas, the adoration of nature being associated with the narrative in accordance with the character of epic creations. In the Vedas, the locality of the scenes which had been glorified by holy beings was seldom indicated, but in the heroic poems the descriptions of nature are mostly individual and refer to definite localities from whence they derive that animation and life which is ever imparted when the writer draws his materials from the impres scions he has himself experienced. There is a rich tone of coloring throughout the description of the journey of Rama, from Ayodhya to the residence of Dishanaka, in his life in the primitive forest, and in the picture of the anchorite life of the Panduades. The name of Kalidasa was early and widely known among the Western nations. This great poet flourished in the highly cultivated court of Vikramaditya, and was consequently the contemporary of Virgil and Horace. The English and German translations of the Sakuntala have added to the admiration which has been so freely yielded to this poet, whose tender gemellas him to a high place in the ranks of the poets of all nations. The charm of his descriptions of nature is strikingly exemplified in the beautiful drama of Vikrama and Orvasi, where the Kyug wanders through the thickets of the forest in search of the nymph Orvasi, in the poem of the seasons, and in that of the messenger of clouds, Meghadita. This last poem describes with admirable truth to nature the joy with which, after long drought, the first appearance of a rising cloud is hailed as the harbinger of the approaching season of rain. The expression, truth to nature, of which I have just made use, can alone justify me in referring, in connection with the Indian poem of the messenger of the clouds, to a picture of the beginning of the rainy season, which I sketched in South America at a period when Kalidasa's Meghaduta was not known to me even through the translation of Chezi. The mysterious meteorological processes which take place in the atmosphere in the formation of vapors, in the form of the clouds, and in the luminous electric phenomena, are the same between the tropics in both continents, and the idealizing art, whose province it is to exalt reality into a picture, will lose none of its charm from the fact that the analyzing spirit of observation of a later age may have succeeded in confirming the truthfulness of an ansiat and simply graphic delineation. We now turn from the East Aryaps, or Brahminical Indians, and the marked bent of their minds toward the contemplation of the picturesque beauties of nature, to the West Aryans or Persians, who had separated in different parts of the Northern Zend, and who were originally disposed to combine a spiritualized adoration of nature with the dualistic belief in Ahrimanes and Ormuzd. What we usually term Peroic Xian literature does not go further back than the time of the Sassanides. The most ancient monuments of their poetry have perished. It was not until the country had been subjugated by the Arabs and had lost its original characteristics that it again acquired a national heterature among the Samanides, Ghaznavides and Seldsheuks. The flourishing period of their poetry, extending from Firdusi to Hafiz and Dishami, scarce lasted more than 400 or 500 years, and hardly reaches to the time of the voyage of Vasco da Gama. We must not forget, in seeking to trace the love of nature evinced by the Indians and Persians, that these nations, if we judge according to the amount of cultivation by WHH they are respectively characterized, appear to be separated alike by time and space. Persian literature belongs to the Middle Ages, while the great literature of India appertains in the strictest sense to antiquity. In the Iranian elevated plateau, nature has not the same luxuriance of arborescent vegetation, or the remarkable diversity of form and color by which the soil of Hindustan is embellished. The chain of the Vindhya, which long continued to be the boundary line of the East Aryan nations, falls with in the tropical region, while the whole of Persia is situated beyond the tropics, and a portion of its poetry belongs even to the northern districts of Balkh and Fergana. The four paradises celebrated by the Persian poets were the pleasant valley of Sogd near Samarkand, Masherud near Hamadan, Shahb-i-Bawan near Kale-Solid in Fars, and Ghut, the plain of Damascus. Both Iran and Turan are wanting in woodland scenery, and also therefore in the hermit life of the forest, which exercised so powerful an influence on the imagination of the Indian poets. Gardens, refreshed by cool springs and filled with roses and fruit trees, can form no substitute for the wild and grand natural scenery of Hindustan. It is no wonder then that the descriptive poetry of Persia was less fresh and animated, and that it was often heavy and overcharged with artificial adornment. If, in accordance with the opinion of the Persians themselves, we award the highest praise to that which we may designate by the terms spirit and wit, we must limit our admiration to the productiveness of the Persian poets, and to the infinite diversity of forms imparted to the materials which they employ. depth and earnestness of feeling are wholly absent from their writings. Descriptions of natural scenery do but rarely interrupt the narrative in the historical or national epos of Erdősi. It seems to me that there is much beauty and local truthfulness in the description of the mildness of the climate and the force of the vegetation extolled in the praise of the coastland of Mazandaran, which is put into the mouth of a wandering bard. The king, Kaikawus, is represented as being excited by this praise to enter upon an expedition to the Caspian Sea, and even to attempt a new conquest. The poems on spring by Enwiri Jalaluddin Rumi, who is esteemed the greatest mystic poet of the East, Adad, and THQ half Indian Faisi, generally breathe a tone of freshness and life, although a pet. Thank you, striving to play on words net unfrequently jars unpleasant, lie on the senses. J. As Joseph von Hammer has remarked, M. His great work on the history of Persian poetry, Sadi, in his Bostan and Gavlistan Fruit and Rose Gardens, may be regarded as indicating an age of ethical teaching, while Hafiz, whose joyous views of life have caused him to be compared to Horace, P.A.B. considered by his love songs as the type ol, a high development of lyrical art, but that, in both, bombastic affectation too frequently mars the descriptions of Natua, the darling subject of Persian poetry, the loves the nightingale and the rose, recurs with wearying frequency, and a genuine love of nature is lost in the East amid the art official conventionalities of the language of flowers. On passing northward from the Iranian plateau through Turan Tuija in the Zend to the Uralian mountains, which separate Europe and Asia, we arrive at the primitive seat of the Finnish race, for the Ural is as much a land of the Anhent Finns as the Altai is of the ancient Turks. Among the Finnish tribes who have settled far to the west in the low lands of Europe, Elias Aldnort has collected from the lips of the Karelians and the country people of Olonets a large number of Finnish songs, in which there breathes a chord ing to the expression of Jacob Grimm, an animated love of nature rarely to be met with in any poetry but that of India. An ancient epos, containing nearly 3,000 verses, treats of a fight between the Finns and Lapps, and the fate of a demigod named Vaino. It gives an interesting account of Finnish country life, especially in that portion of the work where Ilmarine, the wife of the smith, sends her flocks into the woods and offers up prayers for their safety. Few races exhibit greater or more remarkable differences in mental cultivation and in the direction of their feelings according as they have been determined by the degeneration of servitude, warlike ferocity, or a continual striving for political freedom, than the Finns, who have been so variously subdivided al, though retaining kindred languages. In evidence of this, we need only refer to the now peaceful population among whom the epos above referred to was found, to the Huns, once celebrated for conquests that disturbed the then existing order of things, and who have long been confounded with the Mongols. And lastly, to a great and noble people, the Magyars, after having considered the extent to which intensity in the love of nature and animation in the mode of its expression may be ascribed to differences of race, to the peculiar influence of the configuratio of the soil, the form of government, and the character of religious belief, it now remains for IRS to throw a glance over those nations of Asia who offer the strongest contrast to the Aryan or Indo-Germanic races, or, in other words, to the Indians and Persians. The Semitic or Aramaic nations afford evidence of a profound sentiment of love for nature in the most ancient and venerable monuments of their poetic feeling and creative fancy. This sentiment is nobly and vividly manifested in their pastoral effusions, in their hymns and choral songs, in all the splendor of lyric poetry, in the Psalms of David, and in the schools of the seers and prophets, whose exalted inspiration, almost wholly removed from the past, turns its prophetic as pirations to the future. The Hebraic poetry, besides all its innate exalted sublimity, presents the nations of the West with the special attraction of being interwoven with numerous reminiscences connected with the local seat of the religion professed by the followers of the three most widely diffused forms of belief, Judaism, Christianity, and Mohammedanism. Thus missions, favored by the spirit of commerce and the thirst for conquest evinced by maritime nations, have combined to bear the geographical names and natural descriptions of the East as they are preserved to us in the books of the Old Testament, far into the forests of the New World, and to the remote islands of the Pacific. It is a characteristic of the Psetry of the Hebrews that, as a reflex of monotheism, it always embraces the universe in its unity, comprising both terrestrial life and the luminous realms of space. It dwells but rarely on the individuality of phenomena, preferring the contemplation of great masses. The Hebrew poet does not depict nature as a self-dependent object, glorious in its individual beauty, but always as in relation and subjection to a higher spiritual power. Nature is to him a work of creation and order, the living expression of the omnipresence of the divinity in the visible world. Hence the Lear, Ical poetry of the Hebrews, from the very nature of its subject, is grand and solemn, and when it treats of the earthly condition of mankind is full of sad and pensive longing. It is worthy of remark that Hebrew poetry, notwithstanding its grandeur and the lofty tone of exaltation to which it is often elevated by the charm of music, scarcely ever loses the restraint of measure, as does the poetry of India. Devoted to the pure contemplation of the divinity, it remains clear and simple in the midst of the most figurative forms of expression, delighting in comparisons which recur with almost rhythmic regularity. As descriptions of nature, the writings of the old Iesta cement are a faithful reflection of the character of the country in which they were composed, of the alternations of barrenness and fruitfulness, and of the alpine forests high which the land of Palestine was characterized. They describe in their regular succession the relations of the climate, the manners of this people of herdsmen, and their hereditary aversion to agricultural pursuits. The epic or historical narratives are marked by a graceful simplicity, almost more unadorned than those of Herodotus, and most true to nature, a point on which the unanimous testimony of modern travelers may be received as conclusive, owing to the inconsiderable changes effected in the course of ages in the manners and habits of a nomadic people. Their lyrical poetry is more adorned and develops a rich and animated conception of the life of nature. It might almost be said that one single psalm, the 104th, represents the image of the whole cosmos, who coverest thyself with light as with a garment, who stretchest out the heavens like a curtain, who layeth the beams of his chambers in the winters, who maketh the clouds his chariot, who walketh upon the wings of the wind, who laid the foundations of the earth, that it should not be removed forever. Long footnote. Humboldt to Ueber Steppen, TMD Wusten, in the Ansichten DGR Natur, zweite Ausgabe, 1826, BD, IS 33-37. In order to render more complete the small portion of the text, which belongs to Indian literature, and to enable me, as I did before, with relation to Greek and Homan literature, to indicate the different works referred to, I will here introduce some enbitices on the more general aerial consideration of the love of nature evinced by Indian writers, and kindly communicated to me in manuscript by Herr Theodore Gold, Bitayaka, a distinguished and philosophical scholar thoroughly versed in Indian poetry. Among all the influences affecting the intellectual development of Comth, Indian nation, the first and most important appears to me to have been that which was exercised by the rich aspect of the country. Deep sentiment for nature has at all times been a fundamental characteristic of the Indian mind. Three successive epochs may be pointed out in which this feeling has manifested itself. Each of these has its determined character deeply implanted in the mode of life and tendency of the people. A few examples may therefore suffice to indicate the activity of the Indian imagination, which has been evinced for nearly 3,000 years. The first epoch of the expression of a vivid feeling for nature is manifested in the Vedas, and here we would refer in the Ig Veda to the sublime and simple descriptions of the dawn of day. Rigveda Sanhit, ed. Rosen 1s38, Hym. XLVI, p. 88, Hym. XLVI, p. 92, 84, Hym. C. p. 233, c. also, h. 6, Fur. Indo Dicte, 1841, Luz I, s. 3, and of the Golden-Handed Sun. Rigveda Sanhit Vel J. Mu 2L. 31st, Hym. XXV, p. 65, the Ad. Oration of Nature, which was connected here as in other nations, with. An early stage of the religious belief has in the Vedas a peculiar significance, and is always brought into the most intimate connection with the external and internal life of man. The second epoch is very different. In it, a popular mythology was formed, and its object was to mold the sagas contained in the Vedas into a shape more easily comprehended by an age far removed in character from that which had gone by, and to associate them with historical events which were elevated to the domain of mythology. The two great heroic poems, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, belong to this second epoch. The last named poem had also the additional object of rendering the Brahmins the most influential of the four ancient Indian castes. The Ramayana is, therefore, the more beautiful poem of the two. It is richer in natural feeling and has kept within the domain of poetry, not having been obliged to take up elements alien and almost hostile to it. In both poems, nature does not, as in the Vedas, constitute the whole picture, but only a part of it. Two points essentially distinguish the conception of nature at the period NF the heroic poems from that which the Vedas exhibit, without reference to the difference which separates the language of adoration from that of narrative. One of these points is the localization of the descriptions, as for instance, according to Wilhelm von Schlegel, in the first book of the Ramayana or Balakanda, and in the second book, or Ayodhyakanda. See also on the differences between these two great epics, Lassen, Ind, Altertham Skunde BDIS 482. The next point, closely connected with the first, refers to the subject, which has enriched the natural description. Mythical narration, SB. Seely, when of a historical character, necessarily gave rise to greater distinctness and localization, m. the description of nature.